Well, that's an ironic song to sing right before talking about what we're going to talk about, because for the last 6 months or so, my soul has been really disturbed about what we're going to talk about this morning. A couple people asked me how I chose to be preaching about sexual harassment today. The more I listened to stories about it on the news, and the more I heard the Christian community talking about it, the more I became convinced that the church should speak out on this topic. Of course, I was happy to let Pastor Joe do that, or famous preachers on TV and on the radio. And then Joe came to me and said, Vinny, here's your next preaching assignment. And he said, we're going to be done with the book of James, and then we're not going to start a new series. So, you know, preach whatever the Lord has been impressing upon your heart. Thanks, Joe. I knew exactly what it was supposed to talk about, and it was one of those pastoral moments where you want to pull a Jonah and get on a boat going in the other direction when you want to argue with God about your assignment. So, here we are. I want to share some background with you about the story we're going to read this morning. We have King David, and King David is one of the most powerful men at this time we're going to be reading about. Earlier in the scripture, we read about him having taken a woman that he saw that was very beautiful, that already had a husband. He took her into the palace, and she became pregnant with his child, and eventually he had her husband killed. David himself has been married at least 8 times that we know of, and David has disobeyed the commandment in Deuteronomy, which says that kings should not be multiplying wives, something that God was very clear about. David had his first son was named Amnon. He's the main character in the story that we're going to look at today. So Amnon is the oldest son, and Absalom is the third oldest son. And between them is a man that we don't know much about, and it's very likely that he died in childhood because we don't hear anything about him. From what we know about Absalom, later in the scriptures we see Absalom reaching for the throne of his father, trying to take over and become king before his father is even died. So I imagine that Absalom must have had some jealousy toward his brother Amnon, who would have been next in line for the throne as we're reading this story. So this is 2 Samuel chapter 13 and verses 1 through 22. I'm going to read it from the New Living Translation, and if you want to look on the screen, I'll probably have it up there, but also in the take-home, you can look there as well if you'd like. And I will give you a disclaimer. This is one of the most disturbing passages in the Bible, probably not the most, but it's up there, I think, in the top 10 for me. It says, now David's son Absalom had a beautiful sister named Tamar, and Amnon, her half-brother, fell desperately in love with her. Amnon became so obsessed with Tamar that he became ill. She was a virgin, and Amnon thought that he could never have her. And just pause for a moment here. Why is it that when we know we can't have something, there's something about human nature that wants it all the more? This should maybe give us a flashback to Genesis, where our first parents had something that they couldn't have, and for some reason it made them want it all the more. We'll also notice here at this part of the story that the story could have very well ended here with these thoughts being only in Amnon's mind, but it doesn't end here, and that's because there's a family member, and his name is Jonadab. And Jonadab, some scholars would believe that he may have been one of the royal advisors who would be advising the royal family. It says, but Amnon had a crafty friend, his cousin Jonadab. He was the son of David's brother Shimeah. One day Jonadab said to Amnon, what's the trouble? Why should the son of the king look so dejected morning after morning? So Amnon told him, I'm in love with Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. Well, Jonadab said, I'll tell you what to do. Go back to bed and pretend that you are ill. When your father comes to see you, ask him to let Tamar come and prepare some food for you. Tell him you'll feel better if she prepares it as you watch and feeds you with her own hands. All right. So as the story is unfolding here, we begin to understand that this isn't love at all. You know, the narrator uses the word love, but we can clearly see this is not love. This is lust. Amnon is pretending to love his half-sister. Jonadab's plan then is for Amnon to keep pretending. You don't really love her. Let's keep this pretending. Why don't you pretend that you're sick and then you can get what you want? The storyteller uses the word crafty. This should again, to describe Jonadab, give us a flashback back to Genesis. The word choice is critical here because it shows us this isn't just a physical battle. This isn't just an emotional battle that's going on here. This is a spiritual battle. And crafty should remind us of that snake in the Garden of Eden who charmed our first parents to eat of that forbidden fruit. What's also interesting, if you look at the history of this, is that Jonadab has actually taken a sweet love poem, a poem, and he has perverted it. There was an Egyptian poem or song from this era where a boy lies down and he feigns that he's ill. And the neighbors come and they bring with them a girl that he loves. And she puts all the doctors to shame, says the song, because she alone understands the boy's illness. He just wants to be with her. And her presence makes him well. Like Jonadab, the enemy always likes to take something and to pervert it for his own use. So it says that Amnon lay down and pretended to be sick. And when the king came to him, Amnon asked him, "Please let my sister Tamar come and cook my favorite dish as I watch. Then I can eat it from her own hands." So David agreed and sent Tamar to Amnon's house to prepare some food for him. So Amnon's dad, King David, comes to check on him. And as reluctant as Amnon was earlier in the story to act on his thoughts, now he's bold enough to ask his father, also the most powerful man around, to help him. He tricks King David into this. It says, when Tamar arrived at Amnon's house, she went to the place where he was lying down so he could watch her mix some dough. Then she baked his favorite dish for him. But when she set the serving tray before him, he refused to eat. He told everyone, get out of here. Amnon told his servants, so they all left. Then he said to Tamar, "Now bring the food into my bedroom and feed it to me here." So Tamar took his favorite dish to him. But as she was feeding him, he grabbed her and demanded, "Come to bed with me, my darling sister." Now, as we read the text, what happens is we start to see red flags, right? He sends everybody out of the room. Red flag. He asks her to feed him in the bedroom. Red flag. Well, we have to realize that Tamar doesn't read the story the way that we do. She's not experiencing it the same way that we do. It is very likely that she did not see this coming. But regardless of whether or not she knew what was happening, she speaks with great clarity and she speaks with great directness to Amnon. And she says, "No, my brother," she cried. "Don't be foolish. Don't do this to me. Such wicked things aren't done in Israel. Where could I go in my shame? And you would be called one of the greatest fools in Israel. Please, just speak to the king about it, and he will let you marry me." Now, we have to pause there for a moment, because we have to ask ourselves, is she right? Would David allow Amnon to marry his half-sister? We know from the Old Testament scriptures, that it's unlawful for half-siblings to marry. So there are several possibilities as to why Tamar said this. First, it may be that they were no longer following this Old Testament law. We see lots of times where Israel decides they're just not going to follow the laws that God gave them. If they're still following this Old Testament law at this time, Tamar may be insinuating that David will just overlook this law in this particular case. Or it could be that they're still following this Old Testament law, but that the law is not being applied to the royal family. Sometimes laws are applied to the people, but not the people of privilege. Or Tamar may know that David is not going to grant this request, and so she is cleverly trying to get herself out of harm's way. We don't know the answer to that. Regardless of the reason that Tamar did this, it seems to me that she speaks to the heart of the matter. If Amnon really loved her, he would go about this in the proper way. He would follow the proper channels. He wouldn't take something from her that she was not willing to give him. Okay, so now we come to what I believe to be some of the saddest words of this text. It says, but Amnon would not listen to her. There's such weight in those words. He would not listen. And since he was stronger than she was, he raped her. Then suddenly Amnon's love turned to hate, and he hated her even more than he had loved her. Get out of here, he snarled at her. Now that Amnon had gotten what he wanted, you would expect that Amnon's going to be happy, but he's anything but happy. We see that Amnon's love was not love at all. If he loved her, he wouldn't be sending her out at this moment. It says here that he hated her, and in our language we have a word for this. It's called misogyny. It's a negative attitude toward women. It's hostility toward women. If you really look at the word, it literally means a hater of women. Let's go back to the story. Tamar cries, no, no, sending me away now is worse than what you've already done to me. Well, why does she say that? Why does she say sending me away is even worse than what you've done? There is an Old Testament law that stipulates if you rape an unmarried woman, it is now your responsibility to pay a monetary fee to her father, and then you have to take care of that woman for the rest of your life. Now, I know when I first read about this, I had a really difficult time with that. It's hard to imagine that God would put forth a law like that. Why would there be a law like this? Well, one of the reasons, I believe, is because if you were an unmarried woman who was not a virgin, in this time you would find it very difficult to find a husband. So I believe God's law was meant to deter men from doing such things. Okay? God was saying, don't do this. If you do this, here's what's going to happen. All right, back to the text. The writer repeats the same words that he used earlier. Those words that I said had such weight, but Amnon would not listen to her. He shouted for his servant and demanded, throw this woman out and lock the door behind her. So the servant put her out and locked the door behind her. She was wearing a long, beautiful robe, and was, as was the custom in those days, for the king's virgin daughters. But now Tamar tore her robe and put ashes on her head, and then, with her face in her hands, she went away crying. Her brother Absalom saw her and asked, is it true that Amnon has been with you? Well, my sister, keep quiet for now, since he's your brother. Don't worry about it. So Tamar lived as a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house. All right. So word must have gotten to Absalom about what happened to Tamar before he came to her. And his suspicions are confirmed when he shows up, because what he finds is that she's acting out with a torn robe and ashes. What's going on the inside of her? Can you imagine the most beautiful piece of clothing that she has, the most symbolic piece of clothing that she has? She has now ripped it. And can you imagine what's going on in her heart right now? What's going on in Absalom's heart as he sees his sister in this state? And here we go. We get to King David. It says in the scripture, when King David heard what had happened, he was very angry. And though Absalom never spoke to Amnon about this, he hated Amnon deeply because of what he had done to his sister. And so we read from this story, it says that David was very angry. We also read into there, David didn't do anything about it. And that's important for the story. At this point, David should have at least disqualified Amnon from being heir to the throne. But he didn't. Why didn't David do that? That would have been a normal thing for a king to do in this situation. It could be that David's guilt over what he had done with Bathsheba prevented him from disciplining his son. We don't know. Doesn't tell us, but the contemporary English version of the Bible gives us a potential clue. It says, but Amnon was his oldest son and also his favorite, And David would not do anything to make Amnon unhappy. Could it be that Amnon was his favorite and that's why he didn't discipline him? All right, let's see if we can recap what we've seen so far from the male characters in this story. Amnon had a chance to do the right thing from the very beginning, and he didn't do it. Jonadab had a chance to steer his cousin in the right direction, and he didn't do it. David had a chance to discipline his son, in this case, and he didn't do it. Absalom had a chance to speak up for his sister to Amnon or to King David, but apparently he didn't do it. Absalom instead allowed his anger to go underground, and 2 years later he plotted and had his brother Amnon killed. So this family secret eventually exploded and imploded this family. We know that the scriptures of the Old Testament particularly are given to us as an example. So what examples do we take from this? Well, for Amnon, as much as it pains us to have to face, his story is the story of us all. Now, bear with me for a minute because you might take offense to that and walk out, right? We see something we want. We think about it. We obsess about it to the point of making ourselves sick. We are encouraged by someone or something to go after the thing that we want. We may scheme to get that thing that we want. And once we have it, we end up hating it because it cannot satisfy the deepest desires of our heart and soul. While we were praying earlier, Pastor Joe said, may the broken cisterns that we try to drink out of leave us unsatisfied. They always do. And a little kid over here said, what are broken cisterns? What are broken cisterns? A broken cistern is a container that can't hold any water. And that's what our idols are. That's what sin is. Anything that cannot hold water. We know in the New Testament, Jesus says, I'm the water of life. He's saying, I'm the one that can satisfy every thirst of your soul. And a broken cistern just can't do it. So just as Amnon died physically because of his sin, when we follow a course like this, we do damage to our souls. I think that's the big lesson of the narrative, but I think it also has multiple lessons to teach us about sex, about harassment and exploitation of women that has been going on since the beginning of time, but I think now has reached a tipping point in our society. Most of us men are repulsed by the story of Amnon. We would never do anything like this. So what lessons could we possibly learn from Amnon? Perhaps you've noticed that the narrator focuses on Amnon's eyes. It says that he saw that she was beautiful. It says that he wanted to watch her make his food. Most of us are probably aware that men are designed to be stimulated by what they see. And while this design reflects the wisdom and the beauty of our Creator, the fall of man has drastically changed how we as men see women. Men and women are no longer, as in Genesis, naked and unashamed. We might say that we're now clothed, but there's a lot of shame that goes along with the idea of sex. Men in particular are constantly bombarded with thoughts and images that can lead us into temptation. And the pornography industry totally understands this vulnerability and exploits it. In case you think pornography isn't a big deal, let me share a stat with you that I read that directly relates to Amnon's story. One stat I read said that 88% of all pornographic videos showed verbal or physical aggression. So 88%, that's a lot. 90% of the aggression in those videos was toward women. All right. So men, if you're what you're watching in secret does matter, if you're watching stuff like this, it is going to shape your attitude toward women, whether you want it to or not. Putting that aside, let me just say that the result of viewing material like this is that women become objects. And I think that's another thing that we learned from Amnon. That's exactly what happened with Tamar. She became an object to him. She was no longer a sister. She was no longer a woman. She was an object to him. That's what happens with pornography. So what's a man to do with thoughts that he thinks or images that he may see that objectify women? What is a man to do? I think Amnon shows us what we find later in the New Testament, where Paul says that we're supposed to take thoughts captive. If you have your take home, that's the thing that you fill in the blank with, or with the example of Amnon, is that we are supposed to take thoughts captive. Paul says this in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5. He says, "We destroy every proud obstacle that keeps people from knowing God. We capture their rebellious thoughts and we teach them to obey Christ." Paul is talking about what he does in the ministry when he comes up against people that have things in their head that are puffed up against the knowledge of God. He says, we destroy those proud obstacles, we capture those rebellious thoughts, and we teach them to obey Christ. That's what he does when he encounters another person who needs to grow in their knowledge of God. How does Paul do that for another person unless he has first done it for himself? So Paul is giving us a secret here about what to do with thoughts in our head that don't belong there. He says we take them captive. So I want to encourage you the next time you're tempted to do this, to say, this is a proud obstacle keeping me from knowing God. I capture this rebellious thought. Rebellious thought, you must be obedient to Christ. This is the calling that we have as men in particular, to take these thoughts captive and make them obedient to Christ. Not only taking thoughts captive, but also choosing spiritual friends who will help you take thoughts captive. Almost every guy I know that is winning the battle for sexual integrity is doing so because he's taking thoughts captive, but he also has another friend, another man, to whom he is regularly accountable about what's happening inside of his brain. Okay? So I think that leads us well into our next character. The first character is Amnon. He teaches us that we got to take our thoughts captive, make them obedient to Christ. That leads us now to Jonadab. Most of us are not like Jonadab. Most of us are not actively trying to help our friends learn how to sin better or make it easier for them. If you are, let me point out that encouraging a friend to sin, I believe, is just as bad as the sin itself. Let me remind you that Amnon may not have ever sinned in this way. Certainly he wasn't taking thoughts captive, but he might not have acted on his thoughts had not Jonadab inserted himself in this conversation and prompted him and schemed with him. If it's not our goal to help our friends sin more easily, then what should our goal be? Last week's sermon got into this a little bit, that we ought to go after our friends, that we ought to help our friends become more sanctified in their relationship with God. The answer here in this passage is directly in Jonadab's name. His name means the Lord is noble. The Lord gives liberally. And so Jonadab is going against his very name in what he's doing here. Jonadab teaches us the lesson that we ought to be a noble friend. He was not a noble friend. What does it mean to be noble? It means to be someone of high moral character. To be noble means that we give wise advice and that we do it liberally. I have a friend, his name is Scott, and I'm actually going to be talking to him this afternoon. For 27 years, I'm hardly that old, but for 27 years, this guy has been liberally giving me wise advice. And believe me, I have needed it through those 27 years. I can specifically remember one sarcastic, funny statement and gesture that he made. And that gesture that he made woke me up to a relationship that I was in and that I needed to break off this relationship. It wasn't healthy for me. It wasn't healthy for the other person. And it made room for me then to meet my lovely wife a few weeks later. The noble thing to do, as my friend did, was to challenge me. And it's noble for us to challenge our friends away from sexual sin, away from harassment, away from the exploitation of others. I want to ask you a question. Who is a friend that God wants you to hold accountable? Someone who wants you in their life, someone who wants your advice, but maybe won't come out and say it. Who's that person that God wants you to go to? And my second question would be, do you have a friend who can keep you accountable? So that's the second character in our story. The third character we see is King David. What do we learn from King David? We learned that we need to teach and we need to model healthy relationships and sexuality. Particularly, I'm thinking about our children here, what we teach and model to them. David wrote 75 or so Psalms. He had a rich inner life with God, constantly pouring out his inner life to God. But it appears that he didn't pass this same passion on to his sons. We get a closer picture at three of his sons and how they treat women, and it is not pretty as we look at these at least three men in David's family that he raised, or we could say he didn't raise. David messed up in relationship to women, that's clear. He received forgiveness from the Lord, though, for those things, but he was also saddled with the negative consequences, really, for the rest of his life. And it appears that David did not pass on the lessons that he learned to his sons in particular. So I want to encourage you, if you've learned some things in your life, maybe you've learned them the hard way, I want to encourage you, will you be open with your kids about some of the mistakes you've made? Will you be open with them? I know it's hard, but will you be open with them so that they don't have to make those same mistakes that you did? How are we doing with what we're teaching our kids about what God says about sex? Are we teaching them the beauty of sex? Are we teaching them about the fence posts and the safety that God has set up within his laws, within his Old Testament and New Testament, what he says about sex? Are we talking to our kids about those things? Have we talked to our girls about their bodies and how to honor God with their bodies and by the way they dress and by the way they conduct themselves? I would say in our family, we started talking about these things very early on as our kids were growing up. And we started very simple, and we have had more complex conversations as time has gone. This is the call that God's given us as parents to raise our children in all aspects. We can teach our boys how to treat a woman with respect. And we can raise our young men so that they will never raise their hand or their voice at a woman. Teaching is great, but one of the things I realize is that more is caught than is taught. So we have to model healthy relationships. We have to model healthy sexuality. How do you treat your wife? You are providing a model for your sons about how to treat women. You're providing a model for your daughters, if you have daughters, on what to look for in a potential husband. And more is caught than taught. So they're watching everything that you do and everything that you say, whether or not you realize it. One blogger pointed out, talking about men, you may never have lifted a hand against your wife, but you have devastated her with your tongue. You have struck her with disdain. You have assaulted her with your words. You have beat her savagely with your attitudes and actions. The bruises may not show on her skin, but they mark her soul and spirit. Think about it. Everything that we're doing in our home is providing a model for our kids. And if that's what our kids are seeing, that's what they're going to live out, likely, in their marriages. So guys, we have to ask ourselves, is this a wake-up call to us? Sure, we may not be doing what Amnon did, but are we doing something like this? All right, now let's look at the last man in our story. There's one more guy here, and that is Absalom. And I think Absalom gives us the example that we ought to stand up for women. At least three men had a chance to stand up for Tamar, and they didn't. Jonadab could have stopped Amnon. Absalom could have spoken up to his brother right away or to King David, but he didn't. Apparently, nobody spoke up for Tamar. We don't have any record of that. Can I say that we ought to stand up for women? The reason that harassment and abuse is allowed to go on for long periods of time is because men are silent when the women around them are being harassed. What does standing up for women entail? I just came up with a few ideas. Maybe at work it means that you have to go to HR and report someone who's harassing women. Maybe if there's someone that's telling an offhanded joke that is degrading to women, that you might stand up and say that you don't appreciate them sharing a joke like that in your presence? What if we applied the terrorist safety slogan to this idea of harassment? If we see something, that we might say something. I was working as a janitor in college. I was on the third or fourth floor of our building there, and I happened to just kind of take a break from what I was doing, let the floor dry, whatever. I looked out the window, I looked down, and there was a car down below there. There was never a car there. It wasn't a place where you would park, and so that got my attention. And as I saw what was going on below, I realized that there was a man who was harassing a woman. And I didn't know what to do. We were in the car. I could kind of see what was going on. And I knew that our women's dorm was one level below me. And I knew if a girl looked out the window, she would see what was happening. I didn't know what to do. I just did the quickest thing I could think is I grabbed something, not really hard, but I grabbed something and I threw it out the window onto the car. And the guy eventually ended up getting out of the car. He stopped harassing the woman, and they went off walking around the block or whatever. And as I was kind of, as we were kind of working through this, I was kind of thinking, you know, I wasn't sure what to do. And when someone's being harassed, you may not know what to do, but will you have the courage, one, to do something? And you might not go about it in exactly the right way, but will you stand up for women who are being harassed? We have looked at each of the men here in this story, but we still have Tamar. We haven't looked at her. So what about Tamar? The story of Tamar is unfortunately the story of too many women. The men who are supposed to protect them don't, instead actually become a threat to them. It's a sad fact here in the U.S., 20 people are abused by a partner every minute. So in the course of this sermon, it'll be 600 people. And the vast majority of those people are women. One out of every three women has been subjected to some form of physical violence by a partner in their lifetime. One out of every three. A Harvard graduate school found out that 87% of women between the ages of 18 and 25 have experienced some form of sexual harassment or assault. That's like our college age, late high school, early college age women. Man or woman, if you have been a victim of someone else's sexual sin, I think what Tamar's story says to us today is it's not your fault. That is the tragedy of this kind of sin, is that the offended person, the person who has been offended, now carries the shame. She says it very clearly in the scripture. Tamar cries, "Where could I go in my shame? Where am I going to go? Where can you go in your shame if you've been offended?" Let me just say, many of us here in this church have experienced sexual, physical, and emotional abuse. We understand in part what you've gone through, so you don't have to hide. We're here to stand with you. We're here to pray with you. We're here to counsel you. We're here to help you get biblically informed therapy if you need that. Let me say, church, let us be the type of church where people can bring their shame, where they're able to heal from their shame. Because if you can't do it in a church, where else can you do it? We need to be the church where people are able to work through that kind of shame. And let me also say that there's nothing godly or Christian about submitting to any form of violence or abuse. Silence is not spiritual. So if you experience something like this from this time forward, I want to encourage you to step forward to get help. I think Tamar's example also shows us that we can seek out safe people and let them come alongside us. Absalom didn't go about it in the right way, but he stood there for his sister and took care of her in his own home. And there are people who will do that for you, who will stand with you. So we looked at each character in the story, and if you're like me, when I got to this point, I wasn't satisfied yet. I had learned a lot. I had grown in my own faith, but I'm still asking myself, where is God in this story? Where's God? What kind of God allows things like this to happen? And this was the answer that I got. He's the kind of God that made a way of escape for Amnon. Amnon chose not to take it. He's the kind of God that will help you take captive thoughts that don't belong and make them obedient to Christ. He's the kind of God that undoubtedly moved upon Jonadab to stop Amnon's obsessing, but Jonadab didn't listen. He's the kind of God who sent his son, who is the noble one, giving liberally the wisdom of God. Christ will help you to be a noble friend who holds others accountable and who seeks out accountability relationships. He's the kind of God that led David to teach and model healthy sexuality and relationships to his children. Though David didn't get this right, we can choose to let Christ lead us in this area. We can look at how Jesus treated women when he was here on earth, and we can do likewise as a model for our children. He is the kind of God who prompted Absalom to stand up for his sister. Absalom didn't go about it quickly enough or in the right way, but we can choose to stand up for women the same way that Jesus did. As the Spirit of Jesus prompts us, we can act right away because Jesus will be our motivation for acting, and he will be our power. As we move to worship here, Jesus is a chain breaker. If you have identified an attitude or an action in your life that is holding you back from being fully formed in Christ, ask him to break that chain. If you know someone who has offended others in a sexual way, pray for them. Pray for them to come to Christ. Pray for them to conform to the image of Christ more and more. And if you or someone you know has been sexually offended in some way, pray for the chains of shame to be broken. Pray that we can be a church that comes alongside people like this.